It is estimated the annual average global cost of wildfires is around $50 billion, which does not even include the ultimate price of the loss of life. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to examine the controversial use of controlled burns for prevention as data from the World Meteorological Organization predicts an increase in extreme fires globally of up to 30% by 2050. Let's get started. A massive wildfire in Canada sent smoke all the way down the east coast of the United States. International correspondent Roxana Solano shows us the scene. Roxana.
Well, Scotty, in early June, Canada had over 400 wildfires burning. More than 200 were considered out of control. The fire scorched 9.4 million acres, which is 15 times the average over 10 years.
Well, there's absolutely no question this year is an unprecedented history in Canadian wildfires.
Canada received help from countries all over the world, including South Africa and the United States, to help battle the wildfires.
You've had more than 3,400 foreign teams. In fact, you've got firefighters from every continent in the world here this year. So you've got South Korea, you've got Australia, you've got Brazilians are coming, Chileans are here, Costa Ricans have been here, the North Americans, Africans, Portugal, France. You've had them from all over the world, a truly international effort this year.
We spoke to a group of firefighters from South Africa who came to join the fight.
Well, we do have some forest areas also, but nothing on the scale that you have in Canada. So while much of the principles of firefighting are the same, the scale of the operation here is absolutely something to be seen and of something we don't necessarily encounter. And the sophistication of the planning, the way you use your weather monitoring capacity to predict fire behavior, to predict. And that's why you've had no fatalities this fire season. You've had towns that have been ravaged by the fires, but not fatalities because of your predictive tools that you have in place. And then the second major difference is the capacity of a fire to burn underground here. The peat fires, which often survive deluges of rain and keep on smoldering and can flare up at any other time. So we literally have to excavate those fires underground. One of our teams encountered a tree and it looked like a chimney at the top. And when they cut the tree down, there was a fire raging in its core. So that's very different.
We ask, how did this fire compare to what they are used to in South Africa?
Well, we get quite a bit of an induction in terms of wildlife in Canada, bears being one of the key issues. So one of our firefighters was relating a story where he was walking ahead of his team and he came across a bear and it stood up on its hind legs, obviously, to try and sense what it was dealing with. By that time, the other parties joined him, and I think the bear decided there's too many of them, and he wandered off. So they've got bear whistles. They've got training in terms of, you know, avoiding bears and trying to make noise. When we were in Manitoba, it was a very dry season, 2021. The bears were really hungry, and we were camping out in the wild, and they would definitely make a move on our kitchens, and the wildlife authorities had to intervene and kill three bears, in fact, in that time.
Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau thanks their neighbor to the south in a tweet saying, "Hundreds of American firefighters have recently arrived in Canada, and more are on the way. I spoke with President Joe Biden about this critical support, and I thank him for all the help Americans are providing as we continue to fight these devastating wildfires." The out-of-control burns have caused critics to go after Trudeau for repeatedly using the excuse of climate change, saying the country still can instill preventive measures, such as forest thinning, brush removal, and small control burns. Trudeau hit back at his top opposition, Pierre Poilievre, in Parliament.
If for the leader of the opposition to consider that the forest fires that are taking people from their communities and destroying their homes are a mere distraction and not top of mind for people from coast to coast to coast. He still questions whether it exists while Canada is burning.
Meanwhile, Canada is not the only one affected by the wildfires. All of the smoke came down the East Coast and covered the United States in an orange haze. Here, you can see New York City nearly covered. The air quality became so low, people were told to wear masks again and to stay indoors. Schools in New York City and Philadelphia were moved online to prevent students from going outside and breathing the smoke-filled air. Influencers and TikTokers even took the opportunity to joke on the scary conditions.
Wait, why the world? Why the world look orange like that?
Down to the nation's capital, you can see here the difference on a clear day and with the haze of the Canadian wildfires. Outdoor activities were completely canceled for schools in Washington, D.C. due to air quality concerns. The smoke even made it as far as the Outer Banks in North Carolina. You can see here the difference from before and after the smoke rolled in, completely blocking the view of the ocean just a block away.
Our work is we are part of the ground forces. We work in concert with the aerial bombing. But interestingly enough, we have not been confronted with the smoke that you have found drifting from your eastern seaboard right down into New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. Here, the wind has generally taken the smoke itself away from the fire area. So we haven't had much in terms of smoke contamination per se. What we're doing in the Deep Creek complex around the Edison town, which is about 180 kilometers to the west of Edmonton, the capital, we were part of that fires when it flared up in the second evacuation of the city, and eventually, together with a number of firefighters from other countries and Canada, we've actually brought that fire under control, and of course had quite a storm that descended on this area, depositing some 100 millimeters of rain.
These fires have led to Canada's Parliament and the United States Congress to begin drafting legislation to prevent future out-of-control wildfires in the future. For 360 View, I'm Roxana Solano. Back to you, Scotty.
Thank you, Roxana. To give us an inside look into controlled burns and why some environmentalists object to their use, we bring in Edward Struzik, a writer, fellow Queen's Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy, School of Policy Studies, Queen's University, Kingston, Canada. He's also author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. Thanks for joining us. Okay, I want to start with the basics for our audience. What is a controlled burn, and when is it effective to use?
Well, a controlled burn is something that we learned from Indigenous people before, just when we arrived here. It is essentially burning a forest, usually in the shoulder seasons, such as spring and fall, when the spread of fire is not likely. And the idea is to remove excess fuel on the ground, so a lot of dead wood, a lot of really old trees that are highly combustible. And so what it does is it helps regenerate a forest, and it also reduces that fuel, so when the next fire comes sweeping through, it doesn't burn as intensely.
You know, it's very interesting that it goes back to the Indigenous people, but in the present, does everyone in the agriculture and the scientific community actually agree on its use?
No, for the longest time, and I think there's still a lot of pushback, they didn't agree. We are humans that arrived mostly in the first stages from Europe, where fire was not common. Smoke was not great, especially during the very smoggy days of coal-burning plants back then. And so the fresh air of North America is really welcome. And when Europeans arrived and found that Indigenous people were burning in the spring and fall, in places even like Virginia in the 1600s, they put a stop to it. In fact, they took some of them to court. Eventually, we kicked them all out of the national parks, such as Yellowstone and Yosemite in the States. and in Banff and Jasper in Canada to prevent them from burning. And one really notorious scene in Rocky Mountain National Park, as recently as 1939 when that park was established, they kicked out the indigenous people. They actually walked them out. And to make sure that they didn't come back, they actually burned down their cabins to deter them from doing that again. And that opposition continues to this day, that we see it in business communities, in the tourist industry, that do not like to have burnt out forests or partially burnt out forests. They think that it's unattractive for tourists. They don't like the idea of having smoke prevail on, you know, a really nice sunny day. And I'm afraid as well is that we've had a number of controlled burns that have got out of control over the years. It's still a risky proposition. Probably the most famous, notorious is the fire in New Mexico that was a controlled burn that was started by the U.S. Forest Service and got out of control and overran the Los Alamos nuclear weapons site. And causing an evacuation of that entire community and that station there. So we still have risks associated with this. And one of the big problems is we have so many people on the landscape that are in harm's way that it is really, really difficult to do a controlled burn outside of a national park.
You know, there seems something very odd about burning down forest, all in order to protect forest. Some conservationists actually believe that it's wrong to do controlled burning because they believe you're destroying nature. How do you respond to them?
Well, the response is a complicated one. Now, if you look at, say, the boreal forest of most of Canada, parts of Michigan, the Great Lakes states, those trees, you know, are spruce and pine, and the only way they can really regenerate to release the cones from or the seeds from their cones is by heat. Birds and squirrels can do it, but really not effectively enough to help regeneration. And so essentially these trees have evolved to have an intimate relationship with fire. And so fire actually is the best way of allowing these forests to regenerate. Now, in the American West, where you have trees that are a bit more resilient to fire, they're actually pretty, you know, not as the relationship is a bit of a different one. They have very, very thick bark. So you can actually burn that forest and the trees will survive. Those big giants can survive because the fire cannot get through that thick bark. But it does actually regenerate the forest, the small brushes, that are on the ground. Now, the important thing as well is, I think I'll give you an example here. There was a study done a while back, and I was involved in it. I was an observer. I went out several times with the scientists studying grizzly bears in the national parks in Western Canada. Some of those bears we share with Montana. And what they couldn't figure out was why the bears in the national parks tended to be thinner and smaller than the bears outside of the national parks. And then they realized that the answer was that the areas outside the national parks were disturbed more by fire than within the national parks, because in national parks we suppressed fires for so long. And what happened was that you had this canopy that shaded out all of the root vegetables and all of the berries that the bears depended on. And so that was why the bears outside the park tended to do better, although their population didn't grow, is because they didn't have the protection they had in the national park. So it was kind of a trade-off. They had more food, but they're more likely to be poached or hit by a truck or, you know, all of the safeguards that we have in a national park that you don't have outside of the national park. And that's one of the reasons why national parks in Yellowstone and Yosemite and in Glacier National Park, Banff and Jasper are doing controlled burns. One of the reasons is that they're trying to encourage the growth of those root vegetables and berries that so many animals depend on.
So is there a universal policy regarding controlled burning globally?
Now, there's not a universal body, but there's a lot of trading of information between fire organizations in Europe and North America. Here in North America, we have what we call a fire compact that started, interestingly enough, I think in 1954 when Bar Harbor, Maine, burned big, and it caught the attention even of the President of the United States at the time, because this is where the rich from Hollywood and other quarters went to in summer. And when that town burned, they used all their resources to try to put it out, and they didn't have enough, and they brought in Canadians. And that was the beginning of a very long, friendly relationship where you have a now cooperation of intelligence and resources, person power, and the trade-off of information. And so I think this is how we're benefiting globally, because we're now entering a new paradigm where fire has become a global problem, not just a problem in Western United States or Western Canada.
So how do poorer nations in Africa, maybe even South America, deal with wildfires? What kind of firefighting forces do they have, and are forests at greater risk in these regions due to a lack of funds and even infrastructure?
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of like a Rolodex. Every fire manager in every state and every province essentially has a list of agencies that they can call upon in time of need. And there's somebody there on the other line. It's really quite an intimate relationship. When I was in Alaska in 2015 for that record-breaking fire season, the Alaskans were calling firefighters from Alberta to come in and help. And it was just simply getting on the phone saying, can you get here? And we have now a process in place where you really don't, you know, these firefighters aren't stopped at the border and all of their equipment has to be checked by customs. They're just fast-tracked. They can move very, very quickly across borders. And over time, it proved not enough, that we just didn't have enough firefighters in North America to deal with the emerging paradigm. So we started calling firefighters from Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, South Africa, and other countries in the world, because we simply do not have enough people on the ground that are available to deal with this situation that is quickly getting out of control.
So in North America, we are dealing with intense drought and shorter winters, earlier springs, lightning strikes, and even hotter summers. So what conditions on the ground are these creating, and are they similar to conditions in Australia, Europe, and South Africa?
Well, you just simply have to look at it as a chemical reaction. And everybody who's started a campfire on a hike or a camping trip knows is that you really have to get the driest kindling in there to get things going. And what we have now, because things are so hot and dry, we just have this kindling in all forms, be it grass or be it twigs or be it really old trees or dead trees, that are just ready to burn. And there's a simple equation that a lot of weather scientists talk about is that with every 1 degree increase in temperature, you have about 10% more lightning strikes. And lightning, at least on the Canadian side of the border, is the biggest cause of fire. On the other side, it's humans. But still, lightning is a big factor. And so we just have a much more volatile situation that is evolving here. And I've seen situations and been told of situations where even the downdraft of a helicopter carrying a water bucket can actually spread a fire more quickly than dropping the bucket of water. That's how volatile things have gotten in some of our forests.
Wow. Thank you so much, Edward Struzik. Now, after the break, we are going to continue this discussion and look at the impact climate change is having on global wildfires and if one region is more prone than the other. Welcome back. We are going to continue our discussion about the future use of controlled burns, all to prevent wildfires, with our guest Edward Struzik. He is a writer, fellow Queen's Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy, School of Policy Studies at the Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. He's also author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. Thanks for staying with us. You know, I want to start off about your book, because in Firestorm, How Wildfires Will Shape Our Future, you actually argue there is too much fuel on the ground, too many people and assets to protect, and there's no plan in place to deal with these changes. So what's been happening to the way people live near forest areas?
The big cause for concern is that we have an aging population, you know, that doesn't like to live in, you know, congested cities, and, you know, where crime is an issue, where, you know, fresh air is an issue. And so they're moving into these forested environments. We've seen it in California. We see it in British Columbia and Alberta, and it's kind of a paradise for them. But the problem is that many of them are building houses, you know, out of logs or wood, you know, cedar decks, cedar shake shingles, planting ornamental cedars around their house. And all of this is highly combustible. So when a fire tears through, it doesn't even have to come all that close. You can have a fire burning, say, 3 miles away, and if the wind is strong enough, it can blow embers on top of that cedar shake shingle roof and start a fire. And then once that fire gets going, it, you know, it sends embers to the next house, to the next house, and suddenly you have an entire kind of acreage neighborhood on fire. We do have on both sides of the border these kind of fire smart programs that are in place where, you know, are teaching people to be more, how to be more resilient to fire. And I think one of the dangers associated with some of these programs is that it's very good in the sense is that it is making these places more resilient. But on the other hand, it's also making people feel confident enough that if a fire comes through, they can stay and defend. And stay and defend is tricky when you have a really, really hot, intense fire coming in, because basically there's nothing that you can do. And I give you the example of a pyro CB, which is a fire that can start where you have a blue sky day and you have a fire burning, and it creates so much energy that it actually creates its own thunderstorm along with lightning. And it can shoot lightning out 20 miles in advance of that fire and cause a cluster of fires wherever that lightning may strike. These are kind of like the day after tomorrow surreal scenes that we're now beginning to see more often in the forest. And, you know, a couple in their 60s or their 70s just really doesn't stand much of a chance of being able to defend of something like that coming towards them. I've seen these walls of fire and smoke coming in, you know, being pushed by wind, and they really are apocalyptic. There is, you know, the firefighters move out of the way, the helicopters get as far away as possible because they can basically just suck them out of the air. They are very much like volcanoes, moderate-sized volcanoes. That's how much energy that they have.
Also in your book, you've talked to scientists, firefighters, resource managers who are making radically different recommendations about how to manage wildfires all in the future. What are some of their approaches so that we and the wilder inhabitants can continue to flourish?
Well, I think there's a number of things that we're seeing now. We're seeing better predictive services, meaning that we have now some fire weather scientists who are able to better understand where a fire is more likely to start, so that you can move the resources, your firefighters on the ground, your water bombers and your helicopters, into place where they can get on top of a fire very quickly. We're having also, as we discussed earlier, more controlled burns in those areas that are extremely vulnerable. I think that one of the things that we're overlooking and we're not doing enough is that identifying fire refugia, those places that may be in the shadows of the mountains, wetlands, that are likely not to burn that we should be protecting. One of the things that every firefighter will admit but will not say publicly is that once a fire gets to a certain size, there's basically nothing they can do to put it out. They can maybe slow it down, maybe move it in another direction to keep some people out of harm's way. But putting it out on a really hot summer day or one that has wind, it's really impossible. And the only thing that's really going to stop it are basically two things, is a big downpour that lasts for 2 or 3 days or a wetland. This is something that we don't appreciate, is that wetlands are a natural fire stop. Once a fire butts up against a wetland, it basically slows down, simmers, and puts itself out. The problem in North America is that we've drained about 60% of our wetlands for a variety of purposes, for agricultural purposes, to make way for cities. We've also done it for public health reasons, because at one time we believed that wetlands were the cause of a lot of diseases, such as swamp fever. If you're old enough to remember, that used to be a thing. And so we've kind of demonized these wetlands to our peril, because we just don't have those natural stops on the landscape anymore. And one of the great examples of this is that the Horse River fire in the oil sands town of Fort McMurray that burned in 2016 and caused the evacuation of 88,000 people at the very last minute as the fire entered town. Those firefighters thought that there was this wetland that was identified on the maps that was going to slow it down, give them enough time to get the bombers on top of it, the firefighters on top of it. But when the fire got to that wetland, it accelerated rather than slowed down, and they couldn't figure it out until they realized from another department, the forestry department, that they had actually drained that wetland 10 years earlier and planted an experimental forest. So instead of having water there to stop the fire, they had more trees to burn. So the fire just took off and just startled everybody. And that was one of the reasons why that fire got so out of control.
Wow, thank you, Edward, for joining us and giving us some insight into this very important subject. You know, controlled burns are nothing new, as nature has been doing its own version since the beginning of time with a spark from a simple lightning strike. However, as mankind continues to expand its imprint on the earth, nature's course can sometimes invoke more chaos than good. Controlled burns require careful planning, expertise, and coordination with local authorities to ensure safety and minimize the risk. They should be conducted under specific weather conditions and with appropriate fire management techniques, all to prevent the fire from getting out of control. Additionally, controlled burns may not be suitable or necessary in all ecosystems, and their implementation should consider the unique characteristics of each region around the globe. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.